When all the slaves have departed, you will open your gates and allow my unsullied to enter and search your city, to make certain none remain in bondage. If you do this, Yunkai will not be burned or plundered, and none of your people shall be molested. The wise masters will have the peace they desire, and will have proved themselves wise indeed. What say you?
I say you are mad.
Am I? Danny shrugged and said, Dracarys. The dragons answered. Rhaegal hissed and smoked. Viserion snapped, and Drogon spat swirling red-black flame. It touched the drape of Grasdan's toka, and the silk caught in half a heartbeat. Golden marks spilled across the carpets as the envoy stumbled over the chest, shouting curses and beating at his arm until Whitebeard flung a flagon of water over him to douse the flames.
You swore I should have safe conduct,
the Yunkish envoy wailed. Do all the Yunkai whine so over a singed toka? I shall buy you a new one, if you deliver up your slaves within 3 days. Elsewise, Drogon shall give you a warmer kiss. She wrinkled her nose. You've soiled yourself. Take your gold and go, and see that the wise masters hear my message. Grasdan Mor Eras pointed a finger.
You shall rue this arrogance, whore. These little lizards will not keep you safe, I promise you. We will fill the air with arrows if they come within a league of Yunkai. Do you think it's so hard to kill a dragon?
Harder than to kill a slaver. 3 days, Grasdan. Tell them. By the end of the third day, I will be in Yunkai, whether you open your gates for me or no. Full dark had fallen by the time the Yunkai departed from her camp. It promised to be a gloomy night, moonless, starless, with a chill wet wind blowing from the west. A fine black night, thought Danny. The fires burned all around her, small orange stars strewn across hill and field. Ser Jorah, she said, summon my blood riders. Danny seated herself on a mound of cushions to await them, her dragons all about her. When they were assembled, she said, an hour past midnight should be time enough.
Yes, Khaleesi, said Rikaru. Time for what?
To mount our attack. Ser Jorah Mormont scowled. You told the sellswords that I wanted their answers on the morrow. I made no promises about tonight. The Stormcrows will be arguing about my offer. The Second Sons will be drunk on the wine I gave Miro, and the Yunkai believe they have 3 days. We will take them under cover of this darkness. They will have scouts watching for us. And in the dark, they will see hundreds of campfires burning, said Danny, if they see anything at all.
Khaleesi, said Jogo, I will deal with these scouts. They are no riders, only slavers on horses.
Just so, she agreed. I think we should attack from 3 sides. Grey Worm, your unsullied shall strike at them from right and left, while my crows lead my horse in wedge for a thrust through their centre. Slave soldiers will never stand before mounted Dothraki. She smiled. To be sure, I am only a young girl and know little of war. What do you think, my lords?
I think you are Rhaegar Targaryen's sister, Ser Jorah said with a rueful half-smile.
Aye, said Arston Whitebeard, and a queen as well.
It took an hour to work out all the details. Now begins the most dangerous time, Danny thought as her captains departed to their commands. She could only pray that the gloom of the night would hide her preparations from the foe. Near midnight, she got a scare when Ser Jorah bulled his way past Strong Belwas.
The unsullied caught one of the sellswords trying to sneak into the camp.
A spy? That frightened her. If they caught one, how many others might have gotten away?
He claims to come bearing gifts.
It's the yellow fool with the blue hair.
Dario Naharis.
That one. I'll hear him, then. When the exile knight delivered him, she asked herself whether two men had ever been so different. The Tairoshi was fair, where Sir Jorah was swarthy, lithe, where the knight was brawny, graced with flowing locks, while the other was balding, yet smooth-skinned, where Mormont was hairy, and her knight dressed plainly, while this other made a peacock look drab, though he had thrown a heavy black cloak over his bright yellow finery for this visit. He carried a heavy canvas sack slung over one shoulder.
"Khaleesi," he cried, "I bring gifts and glad tidings. The storm crows are yours."
A golden tooth gleamed in his mouth when he smiled.
"And so is Dario Naharis."
Danny was dubious. If this Tairoshi had come to spy, this declaration might be no more than a desperate plot to save his head. "What do Prendel na Gazin and Salor say of this?"
"Little."
Dario upended the sack, and the heads of Salor the Bald and Prendel na Gazin spilled out upon her carpets.
"My gifts to the Dragon Queen."
Viserion sniffed the blood leaking from Prendal's neck and let loose a gout of flame that took the dead man full in the face, blackening and blistering his bloodless cheeks. Drogon and Rhaegar stirred at the smell of roasted meat.
"You did this?" Danny asked queasily.
"None other."
If a dragon's discomfited Dario Naharis, he hid it well. For all the mind he paid them, they might have been three kittens playing with a mouse.
"Why?"
"Because you are so beautiful."
His hands were large and strong, and there was something in his hard blue eyes and great curving nose that suggested the fierceness of some splendid bird of prey.
"Prendel talked too much and said too little."
His garb, rich as it was, had seen hard wear. Salt stains patterned his boots. The enamel of his nails was chipped. His lace was soiled by sweat, and she could see where the end of his cloak was fraying.
"And Salor picked his nose as if his snot was gold."
He stood with his hands crossed at the wrists, his palms resting on the pommels of his blades. A curving Dothraki arrack on his left hip, a Moorish stiletto on his right. Their hilts were a matched pair of golden women, naked and wanton. "Are you skilled in the use of those handsome blades?" Danny asked him.
"Prendel and Salor would tell you so, if dead men could talk. I can't know they as lived, unless I have loved a woman, slain a foeman, and eaten a fine meal. And the days that I have lived are as numberless as the stars in the sky. I make of slaughter a thing of beauty, and many a tumbler and fire dancer has wept to the gods that they might be half so quick, a quarter so graceful. I would tell you the names of all the men I have slain, but before I could finish, your dragons would grow large as castles. The walls of Yankai would crumble into yellow dust, and winter would come and go and come again."
Danny laughed. She liked the swagger she saw in this Dario Naharis. "Draw your sword, and swear it to my service." In a blink, Dario's arrack was free of its sheath. His submission was as outrageous as the rest of him, a great swoop that brought his face down to her toes.
"My sword is yours. My life is yours. My love is yours. My blood, my body, my songs, you own them all. I live and die at your command, fair queen."
"Then live," Danny said, "and fight for me tonight."
"That would not be wise, my queen."
Sir Jorah gave Dario a cold, hard stare.
"Keep this one here, under guard, until the battle's fought and won."
She considered for a moment, then shook her head.
If he can give us the Stormcrows, surprise is certain.
And if he betrays you, surprise is lost.
Danny looked down at the sellsword again. He gave her such a smile that she flushed and turned away. He won't.
How can you know that?
She pointed to the lumps of blackened flesh the dragons were consuming bite by bloody bite. I would call that proof of his sincerity. Dario Naharis, have your Stormcrows ready to strike the Yunkish rear when my attack begins. Can you get back safely?
If they stop me, I will say I have been scouting and saw nothing.
The Tyrushi rose to his feet, bowed, and swept out. Sir Jorah Mormont lingered.
Your Grace, he said too bluntly, that was a mistake. We know nothing of this man.
We know he's a great fighter.
A great talker, you mean?
He brings us the Stormcrows. And he has blue eyes.
500 sellswords of uncertain loyalty?
All loyalties are uncertain in such times as these, Danny reminded him. And I shall be betrayed twice more, once for gold and once for love.
Daenerys, I'm thrice your age, Ser Jorah said. I have seen how false men are. Very few are worthy of trust, and Dario Naharis is not one of them. Even his beard wears false colors.
That angered her. Whilst you have an honest beard, is that what you're telling me? You are the only man I should ever trust? He stiffened.
I do not say that.
You say it every day. Piat Pris a liar, Zaros a schemer, Belwas a braggart, Arston an assassin. Do you think I'm still some virgin girl, that I cannot hear the words behind the words?
Your Grace, she bulled over him.
You have been a better friend to me than any I have known. A better brother than Viserys ever was. You are the first of my Queen's Guard, the commander of my army, my most valued counsellor, my good right hand. I honour and respect and cherish you, but I do not desire you, Jorah Mormont, and I am weary of your trying to push every other man in the world away from me. So I must needs rely on you, and you alone. It will not serve. And it will not make me love you any better. Mormont had flushed red when she first began, but by the time Danny was done, his face was pale again. He stood still as stone.
If my queen commands,
he said curt and cold. Danny was warm enough for both of them. She does, she said. She commands. Now, go see to your unsullied, sir. You have a battle to fight and win. When he was gone, Danny threw herself down on her pillows beside her dragons. She had not meant to be so sharp as Sir Jorah, but his endless suspicion had finally woken her dragon. He will forgive me, she told herself. I am his liege. Danny found herself wondering whether he was right about Dario. She felt very lonely all of a sudden. Mira Mazdur had promised that she would never bear a living child. House Targaryen will end with me. That made her sad. You must be my children, she told the dragons, my three fierce children. Arston says dragons live longer than men, so you will go on after I am dead. Drogon looped his neck around to nip at her hand. His teeth were very sharp, but he never broke her skin when they played like this. Danny laughed and rolled him back and forth until he roared, his tail lashing like a whip. It is longer than it was, she saw, and tomorrow it will be longer still. They grow quickly now, and when they are grown, I shall have my wings. Mounted on a dragon, she could lead her own men into battle, as she had in Astapor, but as yet they were still too small to bear her weight. A stillness settled over her camp when midnight came and went. Danny remained in her pavilion with her maids, while Arston Whitebeard and Strong Belwas kept the guard. The waiting is the hardest part. To sit in a tent with idle hands while her battle was being fought without her, made Danny feel half a child again. The hours crept by on turtle feet. Even after Jiqui robbed the nuts from her shoulders, Danny was too restless for sleep. Miss Andy offered to sing her a lullaby of the peaceful people, but Danny shook her head. "Bring me Arsten," she said. When the old man came, she was curled up inside a haka pelt, whose musty smell still reminded her of Drogo. "I cannot sleep when men are dying for me, Whitebeard," she said. "Tell me more of my brother, Rhaegar, if you would. I'd like the tale you tell me on the ship of how he decided that he must be a warrior."
"Your grace is kind to say so."
"Viserys said that our brother won many tourneys." Arsten bowed his white head respectfully.
"It is not meet for me to deny his grace's words."
"But," Danny said sharply, "tell me. I command it."
"Prince Rhaegar's prowess was unquestioned, but he seldom entered the lists. He never loved the Song of Swords the way that Robert did, or Jaime Lannister. It was something he had to do, a task the world had set him. He did it well, for he did everything well. That was his nature. But he took no joy in it. Men said that he loved his harp much better than his lance."
"He won some tourney, surely," said Danny, disappointed.
"When he was young, his grace rode brilliantly in a tourney at Storm's End, defeating Lord Stefan Baratheon, Lord Jason Malister, the Red Viper of Dawn, and a mystery knight who proved to be the infamous Simon Toyne, chief of the Kingswood Outlaws. He broke 12 lances against Sir Arthur Dane that day."
"Was he the champion then?"
No, Your Grace. That honour went to another knight of the King's Guard who unhorsed Prince Rhaegar in the final tilt."
Danny did not want to hear about Rhaegar being unhorsed. "But what tourneys did my brother win?"
"Your Grace," the old man hesitated, "he won the greatest tourney of them all."
"Which was that?" Danny demanded.
"The tourney Lord Wint staged at Harrenhal beside the God's Eye, in the year of the false spring. A notable event. Besides the jousting, there was a melee in the old style fought between 7 teams of knights, as well as archery and axe throwing, a horse race, a tournament of singers, a mummer show, and many feasts and frolics. Lord Wint was as open-handed as he was rich. The lavish purses he proclaimed drew hundreds of challengers. Even your royal father came to Harrenhal when he had not left the Red Keep for long years. The greatest lords and mightiest champions of the 7 kingdoms rode in that tourney, and the Prince of Dragonstone bested them all."
"But that was the tourney when he crowned Lyanna Stark as Queen of Love and Beauty," said Danny. "Princess Elia was there, his wife, and yet my brother gave the crown to the Stark girl, and later stole her away from her betrothed. How could he do that? Did the Dornish woman treat him so ill?"
"It is not for such as me to say what might have been in your brother's heart, Your Grace. The Princess Elia was a good and gracious lady, though her health was ever delicate."
Danny pulled the lion pelt tighter about her shoulders. "Viserys said once that it was my fault for being born too late." She had denied it hotly, she remembered, going so far as to tell Viserys that it was his fault for not being born a girl. He beat her cruelly for that insolence. "If I had been born more timely," he said, "Rhaegar would have married me instead of Elia, and it would all have come out different. If Rhaegar had been happy in his wife, he would not have needed the Stark girl."
"Perhaps so, Your Grace."
Whitebeard paused a moment.
but I am not certain it was in Rhaegar to be happy.
You make him sound so sour, Danny protested.
Not sour, no, but there was a melancholy to Prince Rhaegar, a sense...
The old man hesitated again. Say it, she urged, a sense...
Of doom. He was born in grief, my queen, and that shadow hung over him all his days.
Viserys had spoken of Rhaegar's birth only once. Perhaps the tale saddened him too much. It was the shadow of Summerhall that haunted him, was it not?
Yes, and yet Summerhall was the place the prince loved best. He would go there from time to time, with only his harp for company. Even the knights of the King's Guard did not attend him there. He liked to sleep in the ruined hall, beneath the moon and stars, and whenever he came back, he would bring a song. When you heard him play his high harp with the silver strings and sing of twilights and tears and the death of kings, you could not but feel that he was singing of himself and those he loved.
What of the usurper? Did he play sad songs as well? Arston chuckled.
Robert liked songs that made him laugh. The bawdier the better. He only sang when he was drunk, and then it was like to be a cask of ale. Or 54 tons. Oh, the bear and the maiden fair. Robert was much...
As one, her dragons lifted their heads and roared. Horses! Danny leapt to her feet, clutching the lion pelt. Outside she heard Strong Belwas bellow something, and then other voices, and the sounds of many horses. Irri, go see who... The tent flap pushed open, and Ser Jorah Mormont entered. He was dusty and spattered with blood, but otherwise none the worse for battle. The exile knight went to one knee before Danny and said,
Your Grace, I bring you victory. The storm crows turned their cloaks, the slaves broke, and the second sons were too drunk to fight, just as you said. 200 dead, young Kai for the most part. Their slaves threw down their spears and ran, and their sell swords yielded. We have several thousand captives.
Our own losses?
12, if that many.
Only then did she allow herself a smile. Rise, my good brave bear. Was Grasden taken, or the Titan's bastard?
Grasden went to Yunkai to deliver your terms.
Ser Jorah got to his feet.
Mira fled once he realized the storm crows had turned. I have men hunting him. He shouldn't escape us long.
Very well, Danny said. Sellsword or slave, spare all those who will pledge me their faith. If enough of the second sons will join us, keep the company intact. The next day, they marched the last 3 leagues to Yunkai. The city was built of yellow bricks instead of red. Elsewise, it was Astapor all over again, with the same crumbling walls and high stepped pyramids and a great harpy mounted above its gates. The wall and towers swarmed with crossbowmen and slingers. Ser Jorah and Grey Worm deployed her men. Irri and Jiqui raised her pavilion, and Danny sat down to wait. On the morning of the 3rd day, the city gates swung open and a line of slaves began to emerge. Danny mounted her silver to greet them. As they passed, little Missandei told them that they owed their freedom to Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of the 7 Kingdoms of Westeros and Mother of Dragons.
"My sir,"
a brown-skinned man shouted out at her. He had a child on his shoulder, a little girl, and she screamed the same word in her thin voice.
"My sir, my sir."
Danny looked at Missandei.
What are they shouting?
It is Giscari, the old pure tongue. It means mother.
Danny felt a lightness in her chest. "I will never bear a living child," she remembered. Her hand trembled as she raised it. Perhaps she smiled. She must have, because the man grinned and shouted again, and others took up the cry.
"Meister," they called. "Meister! Meister!"
They were all smiling at her, reaching for her, kneeling before her.
"Meile,"
some called her, while others called "Alala," or "Kathy," or "Tato." But whatever the tongue, it all meant the same thing. Mother. "They are calling me Mother." The chant grew, spread, swelled. It swelled so loud that it frightened her horse, and the mare backed and shook her head and lashed her silver-grey tail. It swelled until it seemed to shake the yellow walls of Yunkai. More slaves were streaming from the gates every moment, and as they came, they took up the call. They were running toward her now, pushing, stumbling, wanting to touch her hand, to stroke her horse's mane, to kiss her feet. Her poor blood riders could not keep them all away, and even strong Belwas grunted and growled in dismay. Sir Jorah urged her to go, but Danny remembered a dream she had dreamed in the House of the Undying. "They will not hurt me," she told him. "They are my children, Jorah." She laughed, put her heels into a horse, and rode to them, the bells in her hair ringing sweet victory. She trotted, then cantered, then broke into a gallop, her braid streaming behind. The freed slaves parted before her. "Mother!" they cried from 100 throats. "A 1,000, 10,000. "Mother!" they sang, their fingers brushing her legs as she flew by. "Mother! Mother! Mother!" Arya. When Arya saw the shape of a great hill looming in the distance, golden in the afternoon sun, she knew it at once. They had come all the way back to High Heart. By sunset, they were at the top, making camp where no harm could come to them. Arya walked around the circle of weirwood stumps with Lord Beric's squire, Ned, and they stood on top of one, watching the last light fade in the west. From up here she could see a storm raging to the north, but High Heart stood above the rain. It wasn't above the wind, though. The gusts were blowing so strongly that it felt like someone was behind her, yanking on her cloak. Only when she turned, no one was there. "Ghosts," she remembered. "High Heart is haunted." They built a great fire atop the hill, and Thoris of Myr sat cross-legged beside it, gazing deep into the flames, as if there was nothing else in all the world. "What is he doing?" Arya asked Ned. "Sometimes he sees things in the flames," the squire told her. "The past, the future, things happening far away." Arya squinted at the fire to see if she could see what the Red Priest was seeing, but it only made her eyes water, and before long she turned away. Gendry was watching the Red Priest as well.
"Can you truly see the future there?"
he asked suddenly. Thoris turned from the fire, sighing.
"Not here, not now, but some days, yes. The Lord of Light grants me visions."
Gendry looked dubious.
"My master said you were a sot and a fraud, as bad a priest as there ever was."
"That was unkind," Thoris chuckled. "True, but unkind. Who was this master of yours? Did I know you, boy?"
"I was prenticed to the master armourer, Tobho Mott, on the Street of Steel. Used to buy your swords from him."
"Just so. He charged me twice what they were worth, then scolded me for setting them afire."
Thoris laughed.
"Your master had it right. I was no very holy priest. I was born youngest of eight. So my father gave me over to the Red Temple. But it was not the path I would have chosen. I prayed the prayers, and I spoke the spells, but I would also lead raids on the kitchens, and from time to time they found girls in my bed, such wicked girls. I never knew how they got there. I had a gift for tongues, though, and when I gazed into the flames, well, from time to time, I saw things. Even so, I was more bother than I was worth, so they sent me finally to King's Landing to bring the Lord's light to seven besotted Westeros. King Aerys so loved fire, it was thought he might make a convert. Alas, his pyromancers knew better tricks than I did. King Robert was fond of me, though. The first time I rode into a melee with a flaming sword, Kevin Lannister's horse reared and threw him, and his grace laughed so hard I thought he might rupture. The Red Priest smiled at the memory. It was no way to treat a blade, though. Your master had the right of that, too.
Fire consumes.
Lord Beric stood behind them, and there was something in his voice that silenced Thoros at once.
It consumes, and when it is done, there is nothing left. Nothing.
Oh, Beric, sweet friend,
the priest touched the Lightning Lord on the forearm.
What are you saying?
Nothing I have not said before. 6 times, Thoros. 6 times is too many.
He turned away abruptly. That night the wind was howling almost like a wolf, and there were some real wolves off to the west giving it lessons. Notch, Angai, and Merritt of Moontown had the watch. Ned, Gentry, and many of the others were fast asleep when Arya spied the small, pale shape creeping behind the horses, thin, white hair flying wild as she leaned upon a gnarled cane. The woman could not have been more than 3 feet tall. The firelight made her eyes gleam as red as the eyes of John's wolf. He was a ghost, too. Arya stole closer and knelt to watch. Thoros and Lem were with Lord Beric when the dwarf woman sat down uninvited by the fire. She squinted at them with eyes like hot coals.
The ember and the lemon come turn on me again, and his grace the Lord of Corpses.
An ill-omened name. I have asked you not to use it.
I have. But the stink of death is fresh on you, my lord.
She had but a single tooth remaining.
Give me wine, or I will go. My bones are old, my joints ache when the winds do blow, and up here the winds are always blowing.
A silver stag for your dreams, my lady,
Lord Beric said, with solemn courtesy.
Another, if you have news for us.
I cannot take a silver stag, nor ride one. A skin of wine for my dreams, and for my news, a kiss from the great oaf in the yellow cloak.
The little woman cackled.
Aye, a sloppy kiss. A bit of tongue. It has been too long, ooh, too long. His mouth will taste of lemons and mine of bones. I am too old.
Aye, Lem complained. Too old for wine and kisses. All you get from me is the flat of my sword, crone.
My hair comes out in handfuls, and no one has kissed me for 1,000 years. It's hard to be so old. Well, I will have a song then, a song from Thomas Sevens for my news.
You will have your song from Tom,
Lord Beric promised. He gave her the wineskin himself. The dwarf woman drank deep, the wine running down her chin. When she lowered the skin, she wiped her mouth with the back of a wrinkled hand and said,
Sour wine for sour tidings. What could be more fitting? The king is dead. Is that sour enough for you?
Arya's heart caught in her throat.
Which bloody king is dead, crone?
Lem demanded.
The wet one. The Kraken King, my lords. I dreamt him dead, and he died. And the iron squids now turn on one another. Oh, and Lord Hoster Tully has died too. But you know that, don't you? In the Hall of Kings, the goat sits alone and fevered as the great dog descends on him.
The old woman took another long gulp of wine, squeezing the skin as she raised it to her lips. The great dog? Did she mean the hound? Or maybe his brother, the mountain that rides?
Arya was not certain. They bore the same arms, three black dogs on a yellow field. Half the men whose deaths she prayed for belonged to Sir Gregor Clegane, Polliver, Dunson, Raff the Sweetling, the Tickler, and Sir Gregor himself. Maybe Lord Beric will hang them all.
I dreamt a wolf howling in the rain, but no one heard his grief,
the dwarf woman was saying.
I dreamt such a clangor, I thought my head might burst, drums and horns and pipes and screams. But the sad sound was the little bells. I dreamt of a maid at a feast with purple serpents in her hair, venom dripping from their fangs. And later I dreamt that maid again, slaying a savage giant in a castle built of snow.
She turned her head sharply and smiled through the gloom right at Arya.
You cannot hide from me, child. Come closer now.
Cold fingers walked down Arya's neck. Fear cuts deeper than swords, she reminded herself. She stood and approached the fire warily, light on the balls of her feet, poised to flee. The dwarf woman studied her with dim red eyes.
I see you, she whispered. I see you, wolf child, blood child. I thought it was the Lord who smelled of death.
She began to sob, her little body shaking.
You're cruel to come to my hill. Cruel, I gauged on grief at Summerhall. I need none of yours. Begone from here, dark heart, begone.
There was such fear in her voice that Arya took a step backward, wondering if the woman was mad. Don't frighten the child, Thoris protested. There's no harm in her. Lem Lemoncloak's finger went to his broken nose. Don't be so bloody sure of that. She will leave on the morrow with us, Lord Beric assured the little woman. We're taking her to Riverrun, to her mother.
Nay, said the dwarf, you're not. The black fish holds the rivers now. If it's the mother you want, seek her at the twins, for there is to be a wedding. She cackled again. Look in your fires, pink priest, and you will see. Not now, though. Not here. You see nothing here. This place belongs to the old gods still. They linger here, as I do, shrunken and feeble, but not yet dead. Nor do they love the flames, for the oak recalls the acorn. The acorn dreams the oak. The stump lives in them both. And they remember when the first men came with fire in their fists.
She drank the last of the wine in four long swallows, flung the skin aside, and pointed her stick at Lord Beric.
I'll have my payment now. I'll have the song you promised me.
And so Lem woke Tom Sevenstrings beneath his furs and brought him yawning to the fireside with his wood harp in hand.
The same song as before?
He asked.
Why, my Jenny's song. Is there another?
And so he sang. And the dwarf woman closed her eyes and rocked slowly back and forth, murmuring the words and crying. Thoris took Arya firmly by the hand and drew her aside.
Let her savour her song in peace, he said. That is all she has left.
I wasn't going to hurt her, Arya thought.
What did she mean about the twins? My mother's at Riverrun, isn't she?
She was, the Red Priest rubbed beneath his chin.
A wedding, she said. We shall see. Whenever she is, Lord Beric will find her, though.
Not long after, the sky opened, lightning cracked, and thunder rolled across the hills, and the rain fell in blinding sheets. The dwarf woman vanished, as suddenly as she had appeared, while the outlaws gathered branches and threw up crude shelters. It rained all through that night, and come morning, Ned, Lem, and Watty the miller awoke with chills. Watty could not keep his breakfast down, and young Ned was feverish and shivering by turns, with skin clammy to the touch. There was an abandoned village half a day's ride to the north, Notch told Lord Berwick. They'd find better shelter there, a place to wait out the worst of the rains. So they dragged themselves back into the saddles and urged their horses down the great hill. The rains did not let up. They rode through woods and fields, fording swollen streams where the rushing water came up to the bellies of their horses. Arya pulled up the hood of her cloak and hunched down, sudden and shivering, but determined not to falter. Merritt and Mudge were soon coughing, as bad as Watty, and poor Ned seemed to grow more miserable with every mile.
"When I wear my helm, the rain beats against the steel and gives me headaches," he complained. "And when I take it off, my hair gets soaked and sticks to my face and in my mouth." "You have a knife?" Gendry suggested. "If your hair annoys you so much, shave your bloody head."
"He doesn't like Ned." The squire seemed nice enough to Arya, maybe a little shy, but good-natured. She had always heard that Dornishmen were small and swarthy, with black hair and small black eyes, but Ned had big blue eyes, so dark that they looked almost purple, and his hair was pale blonde, more ash than honey. "How long have you been Lord Berwick squire?" she asked, to take his mind from his misery.
"He took me for his page when he espoused my aunt," he coughed. "I was 7, but when I turned 10, he raised me to squire. I won a prize once, riding at Rings."
"I never learned the lance, but I could beat you with a sword," said Arya. "Have you killed anyone?" That seemed to startle him.
"I'm only 12.
"I killed a boy when I was 8, Arya almost said, but she thought she'd better not.
"You've been in battles, though?"
"Yes."
He did not sound very proud of it.
"I was at the Mummer's Ford when Lord Berwick fell into the river. I dragged him up onto the bank so he wouldn't drown and stood over him with my sword. I never had to fight, though. He had a broken lance sticking out of him, so no one bothered us. When we regrouped, Green Gergen helped pull his lordship back onto a horse."
Arya was remembering the stable boy at King's Landing. After him, there'd been that guard whose throat she'd cut at Harrenhal, and Sir Aymer's men at that holdfast by the lake. She didn't know if Wheeze and Chiswick counted, or the ones who died on account of the weasel soup.
All of a sudden, she felt very sad. "My father was called Ned too," she said.
"I know. I saw him at the Hand's tourney. I wanted to go up and speak with him, but I couldn't think what to say."
Ned shivered beneath his cloak, a sudden length of pale purple.
"Were you at the tourney? I saw your sister there. Sir Loras Tyrell gave her a rose."
"She told me."
It all seemed so long ago.
"Her friend, Jane Poole, fell in love with your Lord Berwick.
He's promised to my aunt."
Ned looked uncomfortable.
"That was before, though. Before he...
died," she thought, as Ned's voice trailed off into an awkward silence. Their horses' hooves made sucking sounds as they pulled free of the mud.
"My lady,"
Ned said at last,
"you have a base-born brother, John Snow."
"He's with the Night's Watch on the wall."
"Maybe I should go to the wall instead of River Run. John wouldn't care who I killed or whether I brush my hair."
"John looks like me, even though he's bastard born. He used to muss my hair and call me little sister."
Arya missed John most of all. Just saying his name made her sad.
"How do you know about John?" "He is my milk brother."
"Brother?"
Arya did not understand.
"But you're from Dorne. How could you and John be blood?"
"Milk brothers, not blood. My lady mother had no milk when I was little, so Willa had to nurse me."
Arya was lost.
"Who's Willa?" "John Snow's mother."
He never told you. Oh, she served us for years and years, since before I was born.
John never knew his mother, not even her name. Aria gave Ned a wary look.
You know her, truly.
Is he making muck of me?
If you lie, I'll punch your face. Willer was my wet nurse,
he repeated solemnly.
I swear it on the honour of my house. You have a house?
That was stupid. He was a squire. Of course he had a house.
Who are you? My lady.
Ned looked embarrassed.
I'm Edric Dean, the Lord of Starfall.
Behind them, Gendry groaned.
Lords and ladies, he proclaimed in a disgusted tone.
Arya plucked a withered crabapple off a passing branch and whipped it at him, bouncing it off his thick bull head.
Ow,
he said.
That hurt.
He felt the skin above his eye.
What kind of lady throws crabapples at people?
The bad kind, said Arya, suddenly contrite. She turned back to Ned.
I'm sorry, I didn't know who you were, my lord.
The fault is mine, milady. He was very polite.
John has a mother, Willa. Her name is Willa.
She would need to remember so she could tell him the next time she saw him. She wondered if he would still call her little sister.
I'm not so little any more, and have to call me something else.
Maybe once she got to River Run, she could write John a letter and tell him what Ned Dane had said.
There was an Arthur Dane, she remembered, the one they called the Sword of the Morning. My father was Sir Arthur's elder brother. Lady Ashara was my aunt. I never knew her, though. She threw herself into the sea from atop the pale stone sword before I was born.
Why would she do that? Said Arya, startled. Ned looked weary. Maybe he was afraid that she was going to throw something at him.
Your lord father never spoke of her, he said. The lady Ashara Dane of Starfall.
No. Did he know her?
Before Robert was king, she met your father and his brothers at Harrenhal during the year of the false spring.
Oh, Arya did not know what else to say.
Why did she jump in the sea, though? Her heart was broken.
Sansa would have sighed and shed a tear for true love, but Arya just thought it was stupid. She couldn't say that to Ned, though, not about his own aunt.
Did someone break it?
He hesitated.
Perhaps it's not my place. Tell me.
He looked at her uncomfortably.
My aunt Illyria said Lady Ashara and your father fell in love at Harrenhal.
That's not so. He loved my lady mother.
I'm sure he did, my lady, but she was the only one he loved.
He must have found that bastard under a cabbage leaf, then,
Gendry said behind them. Arya wished she had another crabapple to bounce off his face.
My father had honour, she said angrily, and we weren't talking to you anyway. Why don't you go back to Stony Sept and ring that girl's stupid bells?
Gendry ignored that.
At least your father raised his bastard, not like mine. I don't even know my father's name. Some smelly drunk, I'll wager, like the others my mother dragged home from the alehouse. Whenever she got mad at me, she'd say, if your father was here, he'd beat you bloody. That's all I know of him.
He spat.
Well, if he was here now, might be I'd beat him bloody. But he's dead, I figure, and your father's dead too. So what does it matter who he lay with?
It mattered to Arya, though she could not have said why. Ned was trying to apologize for upsetting her, but she did not want to hear it. She pressed her heels into her horse and left them both. Angai the archer was riding a few yards ahead. When she caught up with him, she said,
Dornishmen lie, don't they?
Oh, they're famous for it, the bowman grinned. Of course, they say the same of us marchers. So, there you are. What's the trouble now? Ned's a good lad.
He's just a stupid liar.
Arya left the trail, leapt a rotten log, and splashed across a stream bed, ignoring the shouts of the outlaws behind her. They just want to tell me more lies. She thought about trying to get away from them, but there were too many, and they knew these lands too well. What was the use of running if they caught you? It was Harwin who rode up beside her in the end. "Where do you think you're going, my lady? You shouldn't run off. There are wolves in these woods, and worse things." "I'm not afraid," she said. "That boy Ned said—"
"He told me. Lady Shara Dane. It's an old tale, that one. I heard it once at Winterfell, when I was no older than you are now."
He took hold of her bridle firmly and turned her horse around.
"I doubt there's any truth to it, but if there is, what of it? When Ned met this Dornish lady, his brother Brandon was still alive, and it was him betrothed to Lady Catelyn, so there's no stain on your father's honour. There's naught like a tourney to make the blood run hot. So maybe some words were whispered in a tent of a knight, who can say? Words or kisses, maybe more. But where's the harm in that? Spring had come, or so they thought, and neither of them was pledged."
"She killed herself, though," said Arya, uncertainly. "Ned said she jumped from a tower into the sea."
"So she did," Harwin admitted, as he led her back. "But that was for grief, I'll wager. She'd lost a brother, the Sword of the Morning." He shook his head. "Let it lie, my lady. They're dead, all of them. Let it lie. And please, when we come to Riverrun, say naught of this to your mother."
The village was just where Notch had promised it would be. They took shelter in a grey stone stable. Only half a roof remained, but that was half a roof more than any other building in the village.
"It's not a village, it's only black stones and old bones." "Did the Lannisters kill the people who lived here?"
Arya asked, as she helped Anguy dry the horses.
"No," he pointed. "Look at how thick the moss grows on the stones. No one's moved them for a long time. And there's a tree growing out of the wall there, see? This place was put to the torch a long time ago." "Who did it, then?" asked Gendry.
"Oscar Tully."
Notch was a stoop, thin, grey-haired man, born in these parts.
"This was Lord Goodbrook's village. When Riverrun declared for Robert, Goodbrook stayed loyal to the king. So Lord Tully came down on him with fire and sword. After the trident, Goodbrook's son made his peace with Robert and Lord Oster, but that didn't help the dead none."
A silence fell. Gendry gave Arya a queer look, then turned away to brush his horse. Outside, the rain came down and down.
"I say we need a fire," Thoros declared. "The night is dark and full of terrors, and wet too, eh? Too very wet."
Jack Belucky hacked some dry wood from a stall, while Notch and Merritt gathered straw for kindling. Thoros himself struck the spark, and Lem fanned the flames with his big yellow cloak until they roared and swirled. Soon it grew almost hot inside the stable. Thoros sat before it, cross-legged, devouring the flames with his eyes, just as he had atop High Hart. Arya watched him closely.
And once his lips moved, and she thought she heard him mutter, "Riverrun."
Lem paced back and forth, coughing, a long shadow matching him stride for stride, while Thomas Evans pulled off his boots and rubbed his feet.
"I must be mad to be going back to Riverrun," the singer complained. "The Tullys have never been lucky for old Tom. It was that Lyser sent me up the high road, when the Moon Men took my gold and my horse and all my clothes as well. There's knights in the Vale still telling how I came walking up to the bloody gate with only my harp to keep me modest. They made me sing the Name Day Boy and the King Without Courage before they opened that gate. My only solace was that three of them died laughing. I haven't been back to the Eyrie since, and I won't sing the King Without Courage, either, not for all the golden Castellite."
"Lannisters," Thoris said, roaring red and gold. He lurched to his feet and went to Lord Beric. Lem and Tom wasted no time joining them. Arya could not make out what they were saying, but the singer kept glancing at her, and one time Lem got so angry he pounded his fist against the wall. That was when Lord Beric gestured for her to come closer. It was the last thing she wanted to do, but Harwin put a hand in the small of her back and pushed her forward. She took two steps and hesitated, full of dread. "My lord." She waited to hear what Lord Beric would say.
"Tell her,"
the Lightning Lord commanded Thoris. The Red Priest squatted down beside her.
"My lady," he said, "the Lord granted me a view of River Run, an island in a sea of fire, it seemed. The flames were leaping lions with long crimson claws, and how they roared! A sea of Lannisters, my lady. River Run will soon come under attack."
Arya felt as though he'd punched her in the belly. "No."
"Sweetling," said Thoris, "the flames do not lie. Sometimes I read them wrongly, blind fool that I am, but not this time, I think. The Lannisters will soon have River Run under siege."
"Rob will beat them."
Arya got a stubborn look.
"He'll beat them, like he did before."
"Your brother may be gone," said Thoris. "Your mother as well. I did not see them in the flames. This wedding the old one spoke of, a wedding on the twins, she has her own way of knowing things, that one. The werewoods whisper in her ear when she sleeps. If she says your mother is gone to the twins—"
Arya turned on Tom and Lem.
"If you hadn't caught me, I would have been there. I would have been home."
Lord Beric paid no heed to her outburst.
"My lady," he said with weary courtesy, "would you know your grandfather's brother by sight? Sir Brynden Tully, called the Blackfish? Would he know you, perchance?"
Arya shook her head miserably. She had heard her mother speak of Sir Brynden Blackfish, but if she had ever met him herself, it had been when she was too little to remember.
"Small chance a Blackfish will pay good coin for a girl he doesn't know," said Tom. "Those Tullys are a sour, suspicious lot. He's like to think we're selling him false goods."
"We'll convince him,"
Lem Lemoncloak insisted.
"She will, or Harwin. River Run is closest. I say we take her there, get the gold, and be bloody well done with her."
"And if the lions catch us inside the castle," said Tom, "they'd like nothing better than to hang his lordship in a cage from the top of Castle Rock."
"I do not mean to be taken," said Lord Beric.
A final word hung unspoken in the air. Alive. They all heard it, even Arya, though it never passed his lips.
"Still, we dare not go blindly here. I want to know where the armies are, the wolves and lions both. Sharma will know something, and Lord Vance's maester will know more. Acorn Hall's not far. Lady Smallwood will shelter us for a time while we send scouts ahead to learn."
His words beat at her ears like the pounding of a drum, and suddenly it was more than Arya could stand. She wanted River Run, not Acorn Hall. She wanted her mother and her brother Rob, not Lady Smallwood or some uncle she never knew. Whirling, she broke for the door, and when Harwin tried to grab her arm, she spun away from him, quick as a snake. Outside the stables, the rain was still falling, and distant lightning flashed in the west. Arya ran as fast as she could. She did not know where she was going, only that she wanted to be alone, away from all the voices, away from their hollow words and broken promises. "All I wanted was to go to River Run." It was her own fault for taking Gendry and Hot Pie with her when she left Harrenhal. She would have been better alone. If she had been alone, the outlaws would never have caught her, and she'd be with Rob and her mother by now. "They were never my pack. If they had been, they wouldn't leave me." She splashed through a puddle of muddy water. Someone was shouting her name. Harwin, probably, or Gendry, but the thunder drowned them out, as it rolled across the hills, half a heartbeat behind the lightning. The Lightning Lord, she thought, angrily. Maybe he couldn't die, but he could lie. Somewhere off to her left, a horse whinnied. Arya couldn't have gone more than 50 yards from the stables, yet already she was soaked to the bone. She ducked around the corner of one of the tumble-down houses, hoping the mossy walls would keep the rain off, and almost bowled right into one of the sentries. A mailed hand closed hard around her arm.
"You're hurting me," she said, twisting in his grasp. "Let go. I was going to go back.
Back!" Sandor Clegane's laughter was iron scraping over stone. "Bugger that, wolf girl. You're mine." He needed only one hand to yank her off her feet and drag her kicking toward his waiting horse. The cold rain lashed them both and washed away her shouts, and all that Arya could think of was the question he had asked her. "Do you know what dogs do to wolves?"
Jamie. Though his fever lingered stubbornly, the stump was healing clean, and Kyburn said his arm was no longer in danger. Jamie was anxious to be gone, to put Harrenhal, the Bloody Mummers, and Brienne of Tarth all behind him. A real woman waited for him in the Red Keep. "I'm sending Kyburn with you to look after you on the way to King's Landing," Roose Bolton said on the morning of their departure. "He has a fond hope that your father will force the Citadel to give him back his chain in gratitude. We all have fond hopes. If he grows me back a hand, my father will make him Grand Maester." Steelshanks Walton commanded Jamie's escort, blunt, brusque, brutal, at heart a simple soldier. Jamie had served with his sword all his life. Men like Walton would kill at their lord's command, rape when their blood was up after battle, and plunder wherever they could. But once the war was done, they would go back to their homes, trade their spears for hoes, wed their neighbours' daughters, and raise a pack of squalling children. Such men obeyed without question, but the deep, malignant cruelty of the brave companions was not a part of their nature. Both parties left Harrenhal the same morning, beneath a cold grey sky that promised rain. Sir Aenys Frey had marched 3 days before, striking northeast for the King's Road. Bolton meant to follow him. "The Trident is in flood," he told Jamie. "Even at the Ruby Ford, the crossing will be difficult. You will give my warm regards to your father."
"So long as you give mine to Rob Stark."
"That I shall."
Some brave companions had gathered in the yard to watch them leave. Jamie trotted over to where they stood. "Zolo, how kind of you to see me off. Pig, Timian. Will you miss me? No last jest to share, Shagwell? To lighten my way down the road? And Rorg, did you come to kiss me goodbye?"
"Bugger off, Frippon," said Rorg.
"If you insist. Rest assured, though, I will be back. A Lannister always pays his debts."
Jamie wheeled his horse around and rejoined Steelshanks Walton and his 200. Lord Bolton had accoutred him as a knight, preferring to ignore the missing hand that made such warlike garb a travesty. Jamie rode with sword and dagger on his belt, shield and helm hung from his saddle, chainmail under a dark brown surcoat. He was not such a fool as to show the Lion of Lannister on his arms, though, nor the plain white blazon that was his right as a sworn brother of the King's Guard. He found an old shield in the armoury, battered and splintered, the chip paint still showing most of the great black bat of House Luston upon a field of silver and gold. The Lustons held Harrenhal before the Wents, and had been a powerful family in their day, but they had died out ages ago, so no one was likely to object to him bearing their arms. He would be no one's cousin, no one's enemy, no one's sworn sword. In sum, no one. They left through Harrenhal's smaller eastern gate,
and took their leave of Ruth Bolton and his host 6 miles farther on, turning south to follow along the lake road for a time. Walton meant to avoid the King's Road as long as he could, preferring the farmers' tracks and game trails near the God's Eye. The King's Road would be faster. Jamie was anxious to return to Cersei as quickly as he could. If they made haste, he might even arrive in time for Joffrey's wedding.
"I want no trouble," said Steelshanks. "Gods know who we'd meet along that King's Road."
"No one you need fear, surely. You have 200 men."
"Aye, but others might have more. My lord said to bring you safe to your lord father, and that's what I mean to do."
"I have come this way before," Jamie reflected, a few miles further on, when they passed a deserted mill beside the lake. Weeds now grew where once the miller's daughter had smiled shyly at him, and the miller himself had shouted out,
"The tourney's back the other way, sir,"
as if I had not known. King Aerys made a great show of Jamie's investiture. He said his vows before the king's pavilion, kneeling on the green grass in white armour, while half the realm looked on. When Sir Gerald Hightower raised him up and put the white cloak about his shoulders, a roar went up that Jamie still remembered all these years later. But that very night, Aerys had turned sour, declaring that he had no need of 7 Kingsguard here at Harrenhal. Jamie was commanded to return to King's Landing to guard the Queen and little Prince Viserys, who'd remain behind. Even when the White Bull offered to take that duty himself, so Jamie might compete in Lord Wen's tourney, Aerys had refused.
"He'll win no glory here," the king had said. "He's mine now, not Tywin's. He'll serve as I see fit. I am the king. I rule, and he'll obey."
That was the first time that Jamie understood. It was not his skill with sword and lance that had won him his white cloak, nor any feats of valour he'd performed against the Kingswood Brotherhood. Aerys had chosen him to spite his father, to rob Lord Tywin of his heir. Even now, all these years later, the thought was bitter. And that day, as he'd ridden south in his new white cloak to guard an empty castle, it had been almost too much to stomach. He would have ripped the cloak off then and there if he could have, but it was too late. He had said the words whilst half the realm looked on, and a king's guard served for life. Qyburn fell in beside him.
"Is your hand troubling you?"
"The lack of my hand is troubling me." The mornings were the hardest. In his dreams, Jamie was a whole man, and each dawn he would lie half awake and feel his fingers move. "It was a nightmare," some part of him would whisper, refusing to believe even now. "Only a nightmare." But then he would open his eyes.
"I understand you had a visitor last night," said Qyburn. "I trust that you enjoyed her."
Jamie gave him a cool look. "She did not say who sent her." The maester smiled modestly.
"Your fever was largely gone, and I thought you might enjoy a bit of exercise. Pierre is quite skilled, would you not agree? And so, willing."
She had been that, certainly. She had slipped in his door and out of her clothes so quickly that Jamie had thought he was still dreaming. It hadn't been until the woman slid in under his blankets and put his good hand on her breast that he roused.
"She was a pretty little thing, too."
"I was a slip of a girl when you came for Lord Wen's tourney and the king gave you your cloak," she confessed. "You were so handsome, all in white, and everyone said what a brave knight you were. Sometimes, when I'm with some man, I close my eyes and pretend it's you on top of me, with your smooth skin and gold curls. I never truly thought I'd have you, though."
Sending her away had not been easy after that, but Jamie had done it all the same. "I have a woman," he reminded himself. "Do you send girls to everyone, you leech?" he asked Qyburn.
"More often, Lord Vargo sends them to me. He likes me to examine them before... Well, suffice it to say that once he loved unwisely, and he has no wish to do so again. But have no fear, Pierre is quite healthy, as is your maid of Tarth.
Jamie gave him a sharp look. Brian?
Yes, a strong girl, that one, and her maidenhead is still intact, as of last night, at least.
Kyburn gave a chuckle. He sent you to examine her?
To be sure, he is fastidious, shall we say.
Does this concern the ransom? Jamie asked. Does her father require proof she is still a maiden?
You have not heard?
Kyburn gave a shrug.
We had a bird from Lord Selwyn in answer to mine. The Evenstar offers 300 dragons for his daughter's safe return. I told Lord Vargo there was no sapphires on Tarth, but he will not listen. He's convinced the Evenstar intends to cheat him.
300 dragons is a fair ransom for a knight. The goat should take what he can get.
The goat is Lord of Arrenhall, and the Lord of Arrenhall does not haggle.
The news irritated him, though he supposed he should have seen it coming. The lie spared your while, wench. Be grateful for that much.
If her maidenhead's as hard as the rest of her, the goat will break his cock off trying to get in.
He jested. Brian was tough enough to survive a few rapes, Jamie judged, though if she resisted too vigorously, Vargo Hote might start lopping off her hands and feet.
And if he does, why should I care? I might still have a hand if she had let me have my cousin's sword without getting stupid.
He had almost taken off her leg himself with that first stroke of his, but after that she had given him more than he wanted.
Hote may not know how freakish strong she is. He had best be careful, or she'll snap that skinny neck of his, and wouldn't that be sweet?
Kyburn's companionship was wearing on him. Jamie trotted toward the head of the column. Around a little tick of a Northman named Nage went before Steelshanks with a peace banner. A rainbow-striped flag with seven long tails and a staff topped by a seven-pointed star.
"Shouldn't you Northmen have a different sort of peace banner?" he asked Walton. "What are the seven to you?"
"Southern guards," the man said. "But it's a southern peace we need to get you safe to your father."
"My father." Jamie wondered whether Lord Tywin had received the goat's demand for ransom, with or without his rotted hand.
"What is a swordsman worth without his sword hand? Half the gold in Castle Rock, 300 dragons, or nothing?"
His father had never been unduly swayed by sentiment. Tywin Lannister's own father, Lord Titus, had once imprisoned an unruly bannerman, Lord Tarbeck. The redoubtable Lady Tarbeck responded by capturing three Lannisters, including young Stafford, whose sister was betrothed to Cousin Tywin.
"Send back my lord and love, or these three shall answer for any harm that comes him,"
she had written to Castle Rock. Young Tywin suggested his father oblige by sending back Lord Tarbeck in three pieces. Lord Titus was a gentler sort of lion, however, so Lady Tarbeck won a few more years for her mutton-headed lord, and Stafford wed and bred and blundered on till Oxcross. But Tywin Lannister endured eternal as Castle Rock.
"And now you have a cripple for a son as well as a dwarf, my lord. How you will hate that."
The road led them through a burned village. It must have been a year or more since the place had been put to torch. The hovel stood blackened and roofless, but weeds were growing waist-high in all the surrounding fields. Steelshanks called a halt to allow them to water the horses.
"I know this place too,"
Jamie thought, as he waited by the well. There had been a small inn where only a few foundation stones and a chimney now stood, and he had gone in for a cup of ale. A dark-eyed serving wench brought him cheese and apples, but the innkeep had refused his coin.
"It's an honour to have a knight of the King's Guard under my roof, sir,"
the man had said. "It's a tale I'll tell my grandchildren." Jamie looked at the chimney poking out of the weeds and wondered whether he had ever gotten those grandchildren. Did he tell them the Kingslayer once drank his ale and ate his cheese and apples? Or was he ashamed to admit he fed the likes of me? Not that he would ever know. Whoever burned the inn had likely killed the grandchildren as well. He could feel his phantom fingers clench. When Steelshank said that perhaps they should have a fire and a bit of food, Jamie shook his head. "I mislike this place. We'll ride on." By evenfall, they had left the lake to follow a rutted track through a wood of oak and elm. Jamie's stump was throbbing dully when Steelshanks decided to make camp. Kyburn had brought a skin of dream wine, thankfully. While Walton set the watches, Jamie stretched out near the fire and propped a rolled-up bearskin against the stump as a pillow for his head. The wench would have told him he had to eat before he slept to keep his strength up, but he was more tired than hungry. He closed his eyes and hoped he'd dreamed of Cersei. The fever dreams were all so vivid.